You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Photography is our conversation today. It's a fascinating topic, and one we haven't done with too much on the podcast. And with me is a guy who knows a lot about it. His name is John Lawrence. For many years, he was the curator of photographs for the Historic New Orleans Collection. And at heart, he still is that before he retired. But he's also the curator of programs for the collection. And they do a bunch of different programs out there. And there's a new book out called Louisiana Lens, and it's photographs from the Historic New Orleans Collection. The Historic New Orleans Collection has a lot of photographs. I mean, that they've been doing, and they're all fascinating photographs. And so it's available. He can tell you how to get it a little bit later, but I really recommend it. And it's just fun just to look through the photographs and talk about the different styles of photography and great photos from New Orleans' past and Louisiana's past. Done by a different style, so it's very interesting. Hi, John.
Hi, Errol. Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, thanks for being here, as I always say. Okay, it's a really interesting book. It's a huge book, and when you open up the first opening pages, has a it's a studio of a photographer and just images of different people from him.
Yes.
This was Bennett Moore's photography. Was that from his studio?
It was yes and no. We believe that photograph was made at a professional photographers convention in New Orleans in the late 1920s. And there are evidence in there that I don't know if it shows in the picture of the end papers because that's been cropped a little bit, but it says it gives directions to the studio or the address of his studio, and it looks like there's something like a booth number on a sign, and so okay. It was probably his exhibit at a trade show, but his studio at that time was just around the corner, as it were.
Has New Orleans always been like a busy place with photography?
It had photographs fairly early on in the medium's history. Jules Lyon is credited with introducing the daguerreotype, the first commercially viable photographic process, to New Orleans in the spring of 1840. And there were soon numerous other photographers who were practicing the daguerreotype. And paper photography comes along a little later. The photographs of J. Dearborn Edwards that date from the late 1850s are to this point in time still the earliest known paper photographs that show what New Orleans as a city was like.
So what were the photographs? What was the meaning for photographs before paper?
The daguerreotype process was a photographic image on a highly polished silver plate. After the plate was exposed in a camera, it was developed over a little container that had heated mercury, and the mercury fumes exposed the silver image on the plate to the proportion that it had been struck by light. It was a one-off item. There was no negative. The plate that was developed was the only copy of that image. And so paper photography, although it was developed about the same time as the daguerreotype, different process, but it used a negative to allow multiple prints from a master object, whereas the daguerreotype, the ambrotype, which was a unique item done on glass, and the tintype, which was a unique item done on a thin iron plate, were all one-of-a-kind images.
This reminds me a little of you're familiar with the Shroud of Turin
Yes.
and all the I mean, to this day, as far as we know, they still haven't figured out how that happened. But there's a lot
Right.
of theories in that one of it was something like photography, that there was something about the chemical they used and the exposure, and that essentially it created an image of Christ. Are you familiar with that?
I have read lightly on the subject, but yeah, there are many light-sensitive substances in the natural world, and I will say the first time I ever saw a photographic print come up in the developer, it was when I was in high school. I thought I had experienced magic. It was it really is a kind of magical thing to see that happen. And however the process is accomplished is I think part of its allure.
Yeah, well, if ever they can solve this once and for all, that'd just be a fascinating thing to know. But you divided the book into different chapters based on the types of the photography techniques. Like the first chapter is about metal, paper, and glass. And so the early photographs we'd see of New Orleans or actually of anywhere would be in that process.
Yes, and the chapter divisions are somewhat of a convenience to the book's chronological laying out of the photographs, but there's often a bright line where a certain type of process begins, but where it ends is usually much less definite. And so I wouldn't want people to hold the notion that just because a new process was brought onto the scene that the old ones immediately disappeared.
I guess some of the most famous photographs in New Orleans would have been the Balak-Storyville photos, where
Yes.
he took pictures of some of the women. Now that's on glass, isn't it? Because there's
Those were glass negatives. Those negatives are now held by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And we at the collection have a couple of examples of those done from the original negatives as Belloc might have printed them, although those were done by a contemporary photographer, a man named Lee Friedlander. There are also about two dozen of Balak's images that are held by the collection that were made from his original negatives, which are 8 by 10 inches in size, but these were put into an enlarger that could accommodate a negative that size, and so the prints are slightly larger. They're about 11 by 14 inches. There are also some pictures by Balak made during his lifetime that show a first communion, they show a courtyard, they show construction projects along the New Basin Canal. He was a kind of commercial photographer who took on numerous assignments, and although the pictures he made in Storyville are certainly those for which he is best known.
Well, there's some of the pictures where it's obviously somebody got a needle or something and like scratched out the faces. There's several of those. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, and there have been various conjecture about why that was done, and all of the ones that I've heard they hold up to a certain point, and then a question is raised as to, well, why not others? There was an exhibition done some years ago at the New Orleans Museum of Art that rather detailed explanation or examination of some of these photographs showed that the emulsion was scratched away not after the plate was dry, but while it was still wet and potentially in development. So it's possible that Belloc was just dissatisfied with the picture he had made and eradicated it, but that is not history. That is just speculation.
What's relevant to the story and to the speculation, if anybody's not familiar with the book, that these are actually pictures of nude women who worked at Storyville. So yes. Some people would say, well, that's why they scratched out the face for some reason that they couldn't be identified.
But it wasn't universal. There are many, many of Belloc's 100 or so surviving pictures of Storyville where the faces are intact, and there are relatively fewer where the women are clothed, but still presumed to be part of the Storyville environment.
Wasn't there a fairly big business about photographer studios, like if people wanted to, you know, take their kids for the communion picture or a wedding picture? I mean,
yes, that was. There's a picture in the book by Florestine Perrault Collins made in the early 1940s, and it shows a young boy in a theatrical soldier's costume being photographed in the studio. And I in studying Florestine Collins's work, it was I'm trying to remember who was being quoted in Arthur Anthony's book about Florestine Perrault Collins, but it was like when the baby was born, when the baby was baptized, when the baby or when the child made its first communion, those were the opportunities and almost obligatory visits to the photographer's studio to record these life's milestones in childhood. And of course, you know, those kinds of things continued on. Perhaps if you got a promotion at work, you would be photographed. When you got married, it was another occasion. But yes, photographers' studios were the place to go to have that done professionally, competently, and in a way that even an accomplished amateur photographer might not be able to do. You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation the photos from the Bennett Moore studio, and the ability to adjust lighting, to have backgrounds and everything could separate the quality of a professional product from one that was made by a dedicated but not fully equipped amateur.
Yeah, the kind of, I guess most people didn't have cameras to begin with at home, and what they did were probably just really kind of really inexpensive cameras. I mean, to do it right back in those days, you really had to be in the hands of a photographer.
Right. The first popular camera was the Kodak number one from 1888, and it was made to be held in the hand. It could be mounted to a tripod if desired, but it used flexible film to make the negative rather than a glass plate. It was designed for ease of use, for spontaneity, and to encourage a wider use of photography. And so those types of cameras based, you know, beginning with the Kodak number one, began to become more popular, more models were done, lenses improved, shutter speeds were shortened. And so over time, the kind of ability for non-professional photographers to make competent photographs grew and grew.
I couldn't imagine a non-professional person dealing with the glass plates. I mean, I think it's like you really have to know what you're doing and have a studio set up for that. Whereas once you come to these rolls of film, you just drop it off somewhere and again, they develop it.
Well, exactly. And the early Kodak cameras were designed in such a way that once the roll of film, which usually initially contained 100 exposures, once that was completed, you would not take the film out of the camera. You would mail the whole camera with the film, exposed film inside, back to Kodak. They would remove the film, process it, make the photographs, mount them on small cards, and send you back the prints and the camera loaded with fresh film. And so their slogan, "You push the button, we do the rest," was designed to kind of make the process maybe seem easier than it was, but to still do that. And there is a picture in the book of an early Kodak image as well.
Well, it just seems like a bulky and time-consuming process, though.
Oh, with certainly with glass plates, that was the case. It almost always required the use of a larger camera on a tripod. And before the invention of the gelatin dry plate, you had to actually prepare the plate with liquid chemicals in a portable dark room. This is if you were outside, and then place that kind of gooey, syrupy coated plate in a film holder or plate holder, put that in the camera, make the exposure, and develop it before the chemicals dried and lost much of their sensitivity. So it really was an arduous task. And if your listeners are familiar with some of the early photographs of the American West following the Civil War, there that process was followed by many of the photographers who recorded those landscapes on plates that were up to 17 by 22 inches in size. And so you think about the logistics of that, and not only making the photograph, but getting back the plate to Washington without having cracked or broken was just it almost defies belief.
I've seen those pictures. I mean, anytime I see pictures of the West, man, I stop and look. And it's, you knew this already, but it really emphasizes how rough it was living in the West back in those days.
Yes, very sparsely populated with permanent settlements.
And the cowboy was certainly not the glamorous movie image that you had. These were like really scruffy kids who'd been on the horse for the last month or so. And, I mean, it's good to see what the reality of it was like, but I think those are really important photos. Also, the Civil
Yes.
War photos.
Right. And again, you're not likely to see any real battle scenes in the Civil War era. You see the aftermath of them, the carnage, the destruction. But the methods of photography there with the wet plate process that I just roughly described and a camera mounted on a tripod, it took several minutes to make a picture, even if the shutter speed might have been only a few seconds. And so the idea that you could capture battle scenes photographically, it was not possible. Sometimes the still photographs made around the time of the battle or in the location were used by other illustrators in the popular press who could then sort of create a sense of an action scene, if you will, through a wood engraving or other type of printed method, and using photographs for reference cues about what to depict in that scene.
Now, of course, in those days, the subject of the photograph had to be still for a while. They couldn't move around while all this was happening.
Right. It was depending on the circumstances, the exposure it could take from a second or two to several seconds to register, and that was under pretty optimal conditions. As photographic technology progressed, though, the emulsions became more sensitive to light. The lenses became designed to al allowed to gather more light to project onto the plate, and so by the early 20th century, you could have photographs that were more or less instantaneous, but maybe not as instantaneous as we can have today, where digital cameras can have effective speeds of a 5,000th of a second or even beyond that.
Talking about the old studio photographers, I've seen images like postcards or things that it was practice. I don't know if it was a widespread practice though, but if a family had a deceased child, they have a picture taken of the deceased child.
Yes, postmortem photography was a regular practice. I won't say common based on the entirety of photographs that exist, but it was certainly a widespread practice from the time of the daguerreotype all the way up to today. I did not include any postmortem photographs in this book, although there are a number of them in the holdings of the Historic New Orleans Collection.
When you're talking about the instant development, somewhere in this, the Polaroid camera came into existence.
Yes, believe
could take a shot believe, and develop it instantly.
Yeah, I believe Edwin Land's first first use of that process that became the Polaroid was 1948, maybe, and by the early 50s, it was pretty. It was pretty available, though expensive, and of course that particular niche of instant photography has its own sort of timeline of development. Those people of a certain age may remember pulling apart the print and the negative, and then having to coat the Polaroid print with a little gooey stick because it would keep the print from fading. And then ultimately you got these kind of wholly self-contained, it's like a darkroom that was the thickness of a sheet of paper with SX70 pictures that would pop out and you'd see them develop and the chemicals would be sealed inside of there and there was nothing to discard. And the process itself was pretty amazing.
Yeah, the image was quick in being developed, but just what you had to do to develop it, it kind of stopped the flow. You know, if there were things you wanted to take, several things, they had to stop and pull the thing apart and then wait for it to dry and then put that gook on it in the back. So
right.
It was not a tedious process.
Yes, and another interesting use of Polaroid that was used by, I mean, I think we mostly think of Polaroid today as an amateur use of photography, and I certainly many non-professionals used it, but Polaroid did develop product for professional photographers where to test a studio lighting setup, for example, to make sure there was not too much glare on the subject or if the light was evenly distributed. Polaroid films could be used to kind of get an instant read on what effect the light was having and if it was the desired effect in the studio. And then you could go ahead and commit your more permanent black and white negatives or color transparencies or other films and with the knowledge that what you were set up to photograph was actually being accomplished.
I guess by the post-war years, what, into the 1950s, when a lot of people having babies, having the famous baby boomer babies at this time, that really was an incentive for the industry to develop cameras that people, the mother to keep in her purse, that were easily portable for taking pictures of the kids.
Right. I think family photography was, or photographs of family members and family gatherings and such, was a big part of Kodak marketing that I can remember from seeing magazine ads or television ads. And of course, in the United States, at any rate, Kodak was certainly the dominant market leader in terms of, I think, both professional and amateur photography. They also had a great influence throughout the world, although in Europe and Asia, there were other large companies as well.
But, you know, once you got that photograph taken, you could do that fairly quickly, but then there was the process of getting it developed. And I know in New Orleans, like Katz and Best Off drugstores had a developing departments. A lot of people took it there, but you know, by the time you bring it to the drugstore to be developed, and they'll say, "Well, that'll be next Thursday," and so it's a few days before you get it. And then you go back and get it, and then they're not all what you're looking for either.
That was a drawback of not being able to process the film yourself and make the prints. And although there are photographs in Louisiana Lens that are likely made by people who sent them out. Most of the photographs in the book are probably, I would say, well over 90% of them were made and processed by the people who took them. So there wasn't that, in terms of the pictures in the book, there was not as much of a delay of that. For example, Clarence Loughlin, for example, whose pictures are in the book, would take the films he had developed, go to a darkroom that was located at Longview. He did not have a darkroom of his own until very, very late in his career. And just, his letters to friends describe printing in the darkroom all night, just to see what he had gotten there. Some of the Works Progress Administration photographers of the federal programs during the Depression, the people would send their film back to Washington, and they might not ever see a finished result unless it was in print or unless they went back and asked to see the prints from the negatives that they had produced. So there's a whole spectrum of kind of time response as from, we take a picture with our phone today and can see it instantly. Sometimes in older versions of technology might have been weeks before a person could see what their labors had produced.
We're talking to John Lawrence, who many years worked for the Historic New Orleans Collection, was a curator of photography, and then also was involved in staging special events at the collection. He has a new book called Louisiana Lens, and it's based on the photography, which is bountiful, from the Historic New Orleans Collection, and we'll talk in a moment about how to get it. John, let's just talk about some of the famous photographs that come to your mind, just from history, or they don't have to be New Orleans, or they don't have to be, but anything. I'll start it off, okay? The Iwo Jima photograph of the Marines with the, putting up the flag.
Right, I believe Joseph Rosenthal was the photographer.
Yeah,
for that. Yeah, wonderful and memorable photograph of that event. Other photographs, and I think people might when they think of famous photographs might not think so much of artistic photographs as photographs that could be artistic but were done for news purposes. The tragic burning of the Zeppelin Hindenburg in Lakehurst, New Jersey, in 1937. The destruction of Japan following the dropping of the atomic bombs. These are, those kinds of pictures tend to resonate with a viewer just because of their, not only the event they depict, but their visual power.
And of course, war creates a lot of opportunities. The famous shot from Vietnam of the young girl who I think her clothes had mostly burned.
Right.
Off.
Yeah.
She's running down the street and she's crying, and that really hit home. I mean, that hit around the world. That people really saw the real horror of this.
It was a very, very powerful picture. One of still related to military, but perhaps a bit more joyful in some ways, as the famous photograph of the sailor hugging a lady, or a lady hugging a sailor in Times Square at the end of World War II. Those pictures tend to stick in our minds. Of course, the picture press of the middle decades of the 20th century were in the vanguard of sponsoring photographers to go out and make memorable pictures. Remember the first cover of Life magazine is Margaret Burke White's photograph of Hoover Dam. The Fortune magazine, whose picture editor for a while was a photographer named Walker Evans, whose work appears in Louisiana Lens, There was a tremendous demand by the public, and I think a tremendous desire by the photographic press to give people images that were not only descriptive but worked on other levels as well.
Yeah, and you know, there was a time when there were maybe two or three magazines, national magazines. They were essentially photography magazines of the news from the past week, Life,
yes.
Look, and a couple of those, because people
Saturday
didn't
Evening
have the visual
Post.
access that they have now.
Yeah, it's a lot of that has you know gone online now, and I hope that if when people come in contact with Louisiana Lens, the book, they will have some of those same moments of response to the photographs, although maybe the photographs in the Historic New Orleans collections weren't always published to a national or international audience, but I hope that they will, these pictures will resonate on some level with people in more personal ways as well.
But New Orleans is so rich in images. Even on a bad day, it's beautiful. You know, it's beautiful scenes out there. So there's a lot of shots in New Orleans, you know, in the French Quarter, and poor people and rich people, and the downside of the French Quarter. But they're all just really moving images. I mean, as a curator, was there any sort of image that you saw more of that seemed to be most popular?
I don't know. In choosing photographs for you know the permanent collection, there was always and you know uppermost is why should this picture be in a history museum? Did it show something that was very specific about a historical event, or did it show something that was typical and therefore part of a larger history? Such pictures are not always artistic masterpieces, although there are a number of them that can be that and are that, and those. So it was a sort of balance. There's one photo album that we acquired in the last several years of photographs from 1874 showing the second great clearing of the Red River from the log jams that had accumulated and made the river pretty much unnavigable. This from Shreveport to the confluence with the Atchafalaya. And of course, Henry Miller Shreve had done that first clearing with the technology he invented in the 1830s, but the Corps of Engineers was charged with doing it again in the 1870s. And these pictures are, they're meant to be a document of that process, but the photographer, a guy named Robert Talfour, who was based in Brooklyn and was on assignment for the Corps of Engineers, made this wonderful series of over 100 pictures that combine photographic technology, industrial technology, beautiful landscape, and this sort of romantically infused vision of the Louisiana landscape. And we often don't necessarily think of landscape pictures as being historic, but these certainly are.
And of course, Louisiana got swamps, and so they got alligators and different critters out in the lagoons and things. So
yeah,
I imagine there's great opportunities with Louisiana photography. I want to ask you a little bit about digital, but before that, I just want to go back when we're talking about the all-time great photographs, at least certainly in New Orleans, was the night the Saints won the Super Bowl, and that picture of Drew Brees holding his young son.
Oh, with the giant earphones.
With those big earphones on. And what a striking photo that was.
Yes, there was, there were, you know, it was at the football game. It was not about the football game in any specific sense, but it kind of crystallized, I think, a lot of that emotion that people felt in 2009, am I correct? When the
Well,
game
yeah,
was.
it was the 2010 Super Bowl to determine the winner of the 2009 season. So,
But yeah, that was that's a very memorable picture for New Orleans as well. I'm sure, Errol, that with your knowledge of the history of Carnival and Mardi Gras in New Orleans, that the meeting of Rex and Zulu is been recorded in memorable photographs. There are all kinds of wonderful pictures of Mardi Gras, and there are a handful of those in the book as well.
Yeah, Oak Carnival is so rich, and not just like the float designs, just people out there and people in different activities. There's so much to shoot in that. Let me ask you about digital photography. What's your feeling about it?
It's the current technology, I think. I think the one of the deceptions of digital photography is that it appears easy. And I suppose it can be, but to create a finely crafted digital photograph, I think you need to put a lot of effort into it. For me, a big difference in digital photography versus kind of not just analog but darkroom photography is that producing, once the file is made, once that digital negative, for want of a better term, is made, making a print can happen in a discontinuous time frame. Most people, when they would go into the darkroom, they have chemical setup, they have a certain, you know, life expectancy of being good as chemicals. And you go in there and you might spend, 8 or 10 or more hours in the darkroom producing prints. As I understand, working at a higher end of digital work, if you're working in a powerful image program, you can say, well, I've got 20 minutes. Let me work on this layer, or let me do these things that I can do. And then you save the file and you can come back to it later that day, later that week, in a year. And it's a discontinuous process, which I think can make for much more efficient use of time. I won't even get into how probably working in front of a computer, for whatever drawbacks we may assign to that, it's probably not as dangerous for your health as working in a room with darkroom chemicals, even if there is a good exhaust system.
You know, something I've noticed, and this is probably petty on my part, but like if you're traveling and you're at some kind of destination or that people want to take a picture of. Now, back in the days when people would have a camera with a roll that maybe had like 20 shots on it,
right,
they knew that they could only take 20 shots. All right. And they probably want to save some for the rest of the trip. People with digital can shoot indefinitely. You know, they're just shooting away and they're just clicking away. And then plus, so many people have their hands up in the air when they're looking through it, when they're shooting. You know, they almost like create a wall for the people behind them. And in a sense, you're seeing this wave of people just doing digital. I don't think there's much thought going into the photography. It's like a machine gun. I mean, just like shooting what you see.
I think there can be a lot of that. And I've seen the phenomena you're describing. And I think part of it too is that if you're standing, I don't know, pick something, you're standing in front of Trajan's Column in Rome, and instead of looking at that, you know, work of sculpture and Roman history, you're looking at it through the screen, and that's the only way you experience it. It's almost like that, whether it's a digital camera or a phone, or it is the intermediary for you to experience that. And I think maybe that's part of the kind of mix of what digital photography as it's practiced today by I would say not everyone, but a heck of a lot of the population.
Well, a lot of these faux pas are probably committed in Italy because there's so much to take pictures of. But it brings to mind, though, being in Venice one time and being on a water taxi, just going down there. And
Yes.
at the front of the boat with these two couples. And they were just doing the whole time, just taking selfies of each other. They went back and forth, you know, one takes the other, switches around, all that. And I'm thinking, these people, they're in Venice, right? And they're passing all these great buildings, all these things, all this great history, and all they're doing is taking selfies. You know, they're not noticing a thing right there. So yeah, that made me think, you know, maybe, I don't know, wish there was another way to do it. But they're certainly here, and they certainly open the opportunities. Well, John, tell us about your book. If people want to get it, how do they do it?
Louisiana Lens was published late last year. It was released on November 1st, and it's available at certainly the Historic New Orleans Collection shop in the French Quarter, 520 Royal Street. It's also available at local booksellers, and if any of those options are not convenient for you, it is available, I'm sure, through many outlets online. And I think it's always nice to hold the book in your hand before you decide you want to make it yours.
Absolutely. But before you do that, no, it's a hefty book. It's like, what, 287 pages. All right.
It's a big book. I'm delighted at the job that the collection did with that. And I just wanted to say one more thing about the book, Errol, is that as you know from having written so many books yourself, that writing a book is mostly a solitary enterprise until it gets, I mean, producing the manuscript is a solitary enterprise. And then, you know, the editing brings in more voices and all of that. But making a book is the work, the hard work of so many people. And I just wanted to thank my colleagues at the Historic New Orleans Collections Publication Department, as well as the people that they relied on from outside the organization to make this wonderful object that we can hold in our hands. And it's a effort of many people. I'm not trying to diminish the role I had in it, but it was a team effort to get this book to be the book it is.
Yet the cover in big bold letters says John H. Lawrence. Yeah. By the way, if someone wants to hold this book while reading it, they better brace their arms because it's a heavy book. This is really.
Yeah. I haven't weighed it, but it's
just defines a coffee
probably table. Several pounds. But
yeah, it defines a coffee table book, but it would be just a great way to spend the day just going through and looking at all the photography. And I wanted to mention, we're talking about the beautiful images of New Orleans. There's a lot of rural photography there too. And a lot of it is Louisiana, it's poor Louisiana, but seeing the way that those people live is just really moving. I mean, it's quite an education to do that. So
yes, it's the collections do embrace the entirety of Louisiana, although the emphasis is certainly on New Orleans as a collecting focus. But I did want the book to show that it was not just New Orleans pictures, but pictures beyond the city and parish limits and indeed the metro area.
Okay. Are you enjoying retirement?
I am. Having this book was it sort of really began my last year of employment, the year of COVID, and continued for about a year and a half after that, until the book was sent off to the press. Living here in Mississippi has been a change of pace. I still get to New Orleans probably a couple of times a month for different reasons. So I've enjoyed retirement very much. Thank you.
And you and Priscilla live on a farm, don't you, out there?
It is a farmstead. It was a place that had been farmed by Priscilla's ancestors, and We are happily ensconced here now in the old farmhouse with in a beautiful setting there. Right now, as we speak, there are banks of azaleas in full bloom up and down the road, and it's nice.
Jed, I've known you as a real urban guy. To think of you living in the farmhouse now, it's kind of surprising, but also very refreshing, especially
yes,
with the azaleas.
And you know, without getting too personal about all of this, this was a designed move. This had nothing to do with, you know, being dissatisfied in New Orleans. It was just we were married 35 years ago, we knew that we would retire here. And so when my retirement came to pass, this is where we came.
We'll take a lot of pictures out there. So, John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Errol.
And again, I want to remind anybody, if they want to see the book, check with the Historic New Orleans Collection, or check the websites like Amazon and all the other places. And
right. And if you're in your neighborhood bookstore as well, they should have it or be able to get it without any trouble.
So. Yeah, support the local bookstores. I mean, there's a real need for that too. So thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Errol.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.